So many of the, in fact, pretty much all of the precepts and also the rules for the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, they're worded in terms of things not to do.
Right.
As opposed to like, I don't know, like aspirations for our conduct.
Right.
Why is that?
Well, I mean,
one of the things is there's a difference between Dhamma and Vinaya. Dhamma is much more the aspiration, and Vinaya is the how do you keep your nose clean, sort of. how do you keep it so you don't go off the rails, or and also, I mean, there is you can't mandate goodness. So, I mean, you can't mandate purity. So at least having, at least don't do this and don't do that, and have those boundaries, and then that opens up the possibility of people rising to the occasion for themselves. So you can't sort of force people to be good, or to be pure-hearted, or to be compassionate. If you mandated, if you had a rule of you can't think bad thoughts and you can't do anything that's not compassionate, then I mean, who could live like that? There. So it's much more around the sense of okay, don't. Don't hit each other. Don't argue. So things like that. So it's much more keeping a foundation that one can sow the seeds of that goodness and that purity. Yeah, and that's another aspect of it is that the Vinaya is only about actions of body and speech. There isn't anything about mental states at all. I mean, it's because that's again, we all know how much our minds are out of control. So if you've got a rule about not thinking something, then you're not feeling a particular way. I mean, it's just you can imagine what it do. Just really screw people up.
So can you talk a little bit about the different methods that the Sangha uses, the Vinaya provides for having the monks keep rules? Like, is there any punishment, or how does that work?
Well, there's not. generally it's not a punitive system. In the same way that you can't mandate people to be good, you can't beat them into submission either. So, and that's not the once you've got a certain standard, a comprehensive standard like the like the Vinaya, which you volunteer to take on, and particularly the way Ajahn Chah and good monasteries tend to do it, that there is a period of training ahead of time, so that you actually know what you're getting yourself in for, and so that you can make that commitment yourself to live in that way. And if people don't really have either the discipline or the inclination to follow those standards, oftentimes they'll just either not make the commitment, or they'll try it out for a little while and they'll disappear, or they'll, you know, they just find themselves either uncomfortable within themselves or at odds with others, because their kind of commitment to keeping standards of conduct and standards of training behavior are quite different from the standards that are upheld in the Vinaya and by the community. So it's kind of a self-selecting system, and on a certain that's quite beautiful, because again you can't really make people live by these rules. I mean, it's a life of renunciation. It's a life of simplicity and kind of composure and restraint that is really not. It's so different than the world, so you really want to have to do it yourself. And then, of course, as a monastery, you want to be trying to encouraging people to be keeping the training and by seeing the benefit of it, seeing the benefit of that restraint and that simplicity, seeing the usefulness and the function of it, so that one has some inspiration to do it, because you can't just force yourself out of, because it's a good idea, and even if it is a good idea, it's still, you can't sort of force yourself or push yourself to be doing it. But as you understand, take the time to understand, and the community itself, has to be living in a way that inspires people to keep the training, in the sense that, you know, if somebody comes in and to the community, and the community is they might be keeping all the rules, but they're bickering and fighting and kind of totally fear-ridden and tense, then that's not really a motivation for others to take it on. So that as one is using the training, that again, that's where Dhamma and Vinaya have to go together, so that the Vinaya is in support of that practice of Dhamma, so that there's, and Dhamma of you know, for restraint, for relinquishment, for peace, for knowledge, and as those things are gained or tasted or seen as a fruit, then the Vinaya also is a sensible thing to be doing.
Thank you.
I think I can speak for many of us, certainly myself, that even on the best of days, that, you know, it's not always, we can't always keep all the rules perfectly, you know, even when we're trying our hardest. And so, like, the Vinaya provides, like, a few different ways, probably foremost among them, confession for this. And so can you talk about the role of confession and maybe some of the other methods for rectifying or coming to terms with offenses?
Yeah, well, I think that's the certainly the main you know, one of the main ways of recognizing that one there's just so many rules. I mean, it's one, you can't, it's hard to keep them all in mind all at the same time, and also recognizing that there's minor rules and major rules, some of the minor rules are it's easy to fall into an offense, but then it's not that spirit of confession is a spirit of renewal, so that sense of renewing one's own commitment, and like in during the confession, is, you know, sort of, do you see that as an offense? You confess the offense, and you see that, and say, yes, I see that. I'll try to make amends, and it's sort of so that it's giving us the opportunity to see it and make that determination. And so that as one recognition of rules or sort of like boundaries and supports for, you know, so many mindfulness, for reflection, for restraint, and that having that, even when one recognizes that, oh, okay, I missed the boat on that one. It's a reminder to investigate, because that's so important that the rules aren't there, again, as a punitive thing, or even as a coercion to stay within. They're tools to be able to turn back attention and investigate what was the mental state that was led me to what was the volition in the mind. Zajian Chah makes a strong point of that. Sila, whether it's for the lay community or for the monastic community, it's a tool for understanding volition. And volition is where we create kamma. The Buddha is very explicit in that volition, jhetana, is kamma. So that as we, having those sort of boundaries and those rules and those standards, where when we transgress something, or we do something that is either brought to our attention by somebody else, or brought to attention our through our own recollection, then it's important to be going back and say, well, what was the intention there? What was the volition? What was moving my mind? That's how one learns and is able to free oneself from that habit of creating kamma. It's like the there's suttas where the Buddha takes the same template as the Four Noble Truths and applies it to to kamma, so that there is kamma, there's the origin of kamma, there's the cessation of kamma, there's the path leading to cessation of kamma, so that it's equated with the cessation of dukkha. Those impulses are so strong and so second nature that it's helpful to have the variety of rules and guidelines that help us reflect and refine that reflection. I'd say so, recognizing how these Dhamma and Vinaya are not separate things. They work together in the same way that as one is more and more grounded in Dhamma, especially in terms of relinquishment and self-effacement, not holding to a sense of self or views, and Vinaya becomes really straightforward, because very easy, very straightforward, because one's looking at it in a completely different way.
It sort of reminds me of, like, in the suttas, how, like, a stream enter, you know, when the Buddha describes stream entry, very oftentimes sila and view are mentioned in that.
The sila that is cherished by the noble ones. That sense of the this is a noble way of establishing oneself in conduct, and it becomes second nature. It's not as if it's and that's part of that description of the sila of a stream enterer, sort of unmottled, unblotched, unstained, untorn, unrent. It's a natural imbuing of the heart within that, and it isn't as if it's having to be forced in some way.
Well, I'm sorry, a little tangent on that notice. I've always been confused about that with Sarakhani.
Because
he took to drink, so...
Yeah.
But he was a stream enterer.
You're going to have to pay attention to sequences.
Okay, that's actually a good point. That's a good point in the suttas, yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't as if he became a stream enterer and then took to drink. He was this person who was known for drinking and being a carouser, who then got faith in the Buddha and then realizing stream entry. And there's lots of ne'er-do-wells that have had realizations, but their conduct really changes. I remember one person who, he was a gangster, Banpei, which Banpei is a port, fishing port, had a large sort of gang, mafia, he got faith in Ajahn Chah, got faith in Dhamma, got faith in Ajahn Chah, And he went and stayed. Ajahn Narong at Banpei. he went to see him first, and Ajahn Narong quite wisely said, "Oh, this is beyond my pay level." And I said, "I'll take you to Ajahn Chah," and he stayed at what? Ajahn Chah had him stay underneath his kuti, and just took him under his wing, and he stayed there for a week or 2 weeks, and just. Lots and lots of discussions, and then just looking after Ajahn Chah. And this is a serious gangster. I mean, it's lots and lots of his own. Murders that he himself committed, as well as his gang, and then holding control of all of his business interests in a fishing port. That's pretty rough. And he went back, and tried to convince his younger brother was another sort of head of the gang. He was the real head of the gang. His brother was there, plus others. Tried to convince his gang that they were going to be keeping the five precepts from now. it was met with skepticism. he got murdered. He knew that. It took about 2 years for his power to dissipate, and if people felt strong enough to get rid of him, he was murdered. But I mean, he knew that, and he knew that world well enough And he had already made all his sort of preparations so that sort of his family and whatnot were looked after. So I mean, it was very interesting.
A phrase that you used in the other day was skillfully adding to an unpredictable situation. And I thought that was it's very interesting, very curious, and of course that's what you've been talking about here, but could you continue, like, maybe like that kind of that clarity of conduct and view, like how that frees one to contribute skillfully to an uncertain situation?
Well, yeah, I think there's a certain confidence and clarity, and and also one is tuning in, as opposed to, you know, going through one's list of fallback views and kind of positions. So one's attuning to this situation. So then, skillfully. Being it, because sometimes it's important to say to act or to do something it's similar to that. What comes to mind is how the Buddha say answers questions. You know, that's a really good, there's certain questions that are it's appropriate to give a categorical answer. Sometimes it's appropriate to ask a counter question. Sometimes it's important to clarify the Sometimes it's important to just not answer, just not deal with it. So that similarly in situations where, you know, sometimes it's important to wait. Sometimes it's important to do something or say something. Sometimes it's important to be do something, but to be very cautious and plant the seed, see where it goes, and then follow up on it. And sometimes you have to be willing to go ahead and make a commitment or something, and then sometimes you need to be ready to pull back as well. But still, it takes more than just a tentative nudge. Sometimes things need a push. Knowing that it's unpredictable, uncertain. Again, that Ajahn Chah's, it's uncertain. but there is a trust in this Dhamma Vinaya, and you see just over and over again that it works, and even when it doesn't. That doesn't mean that it's just one's own skill level wasn't up to match to the situation, or the situation was intractable. So it's having that confidence and clarity of what is useful, when is it important to be forceful or to push something, and when is it important to wait or hold back or be willing to watch and gather more information. Because sometimes that makes us uneasy. I just want to do something. Yeah. And sometimes, let's just watch this for a bit, see where this goes. And then you get a bit more clarity of what might be more useful. So part of it is that skillfulness is also there's a certain intuition and experience that's helpful, but a certain trust in the Dhamma.
Was there ever a time when you were in such a situation and you were trying to watch and feel it out? Think that something should be done, but you never really got a clear sense of what was going to work. So you maybe just tried something, see what happens.
The whole spectrum and the whole range. I mean, it's certainly there's been plenty of I don't know, and it's okay to not know, because you just don't, because sometimes, it feels uncomfortable to not know, so then we override that with some half-baked idea of what we think it should be. So then it ends up getting more complicated. there's all the different permutations, but there's plenty of times where I'm really don't not sure at all. And given the the general, that's why I say that that's the unpredictable nature of human existence. There's not a whole lot we actually do know, you know, for certain.
It's more something you said one time that's had a, I bring up all the time, is that the transcendent of doubt isn't getting the answers to your doubt, it's being comfortable with the doubt. And that was like, here you go.
Thank you. Sometimes it's good to remember what I said. Yeah, because those are, because that's so much of, you know, doubt's uncomfortable. But you know, there's so much of ourselves and the world that is, we're doubting about something that's worthy of doubt. It's like the in the Kalama Sutta. But then sort of as we're more and more willing to be comfortable with that doubt, then things start to open up. Things become a bit more clear.
And sometimes there's the phrase like a practitioner has gone beyond doubt. Is that a certain confidence on the inside, or is that relinquishment?
Well, I mean, they've been gone. I mean, you have to be clear about gone beyond doubt in terms of they've gone beyond doubt as to what's the nature of dukkha, what's the cause of dukkha, what's the cessation of dukkha, what's the path leading to cessation of dukkha. If you've got some practitioner who is so full of the fire of the Dhamma, and they're going to and I've seen this, where they're telling people what to do with their lives and telling them what's going on in their minds, and I said, ooh, there's a lot of train wreckage after that. Because people want to believe. And sometimes it's a real kindness to say, stick with that doubt. Or you got to figure this out for yourself. Now, I've seen, Ajahn Chah was an incredibly charismatic and incredibly clear, but he was also very cautious about things that he didn't know. There was one time in his community, where one of the monks was accused of a heavy offense, and he was, and it was huge. I mean, the lay people were split, the police were, because it was turning into this huge conflict locally, and then it was. Kind of police, government officials, and then they get Ajahn Chah. You've got to come and sort this out. You've got to fix this. And so he went, and he got up on the Dhamma seat, and the hall's full. There's people, cars everywhere, and basically what he said, sutti asutti pachatang, is sort of pure or impure, each person knows for themselves. He said, there's only two people who know what the actuality of this is. I don't know. Sometimes it's not clear in the moment, and sometimes so that on a certain level it's a real letdown, But it's actually more in accord with Dhamma. And, you know, to get up in front of people who are wanting, you know, one camp wants one answer and the other camp wants another answer. And to be able to hold it so that one isn't shaken by that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.